That's out.
Oh, he dropped it. I don't believe it. That's unbelievable. He was throwing it up. He thought he had it. It was a little lollipop. And the man who did so well with the bat has taken his eye off the ball. And the ball has just dribbled out of his fingers. He was about to throw it up.
Hey, great cricket.
The Great Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the great cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast. On today's show, Mohammad Shami takes a hat-trick in the final over to get India out of jail against Afghanistan. New Zealand remain undefeated thanks to a Trent Bolt boundary catch off the last ball as Carlos Braithwaite tries to hit a six to win the game. The most out-of-shape man to grace a World Cup since Dwayne Leverock, Lasith Malinga, absolutely destroys England, somehow disproving that athleticism in cricket is important and beach runs in winter mean absolutely nothing. Suddenly, England are in a race for fourth, so we celebrate Australia's World Cup and Ashes win. Mark Butcher joins the show to talk about his new album Songs from the Sun House, plus some World Cup views as well. Hashtag RTDC goes into valid visas, alpha dogs, embarrassing moments in front of school children, and Mark Ramprakash. My name is Ian Higgins and I'm joined by Dave Edwards in Sydney and Sam Perry in Melbourne. And boys, Nasser Hussain said on Twitter today, it's a good week for the World Cup. Sun out, close games, lower scores, more in it for the bowlers. Proper cricket. So, why did he bowl first at the Gabba in 2002?
Oh, cheers for the lead in there, Higgos. Great to know where to take that. But, it's been a very good week for the World Cup. Thank you to all those who've written in with the usual, typical, aggressive correspondence, but also wanting to be friends at the same time by saying that whatever we've said about England must be wrong, judged based on what happened against Sri Lanka. But it has been interesting, isn't it? Like, this World Cup is becoming about aura and intangibles. It's not about bilateral series and like superior tactics. Maybe we do have egg on our faces, you know, by thinking England can actually achieve something with the way they've been batting. Maybe it is just about Australians being scary, you know. Maybe it is about, I don't know.
Well, isn't that just like interesting when like everyone's decrying this tournament as just boring and predictable and geared towards ensuring the big three make the semis. And there's just a couple of little thrillers come out. That's all I'm saying. Like, there's nothing sus about it. I'm sure everything is above board here. But, you know, it's really worked out in the favour of the ICC. And now we're excited again. I'm excited again about the World Cup.
Well, let's get straight into it. England, Sri Lanka. I mean, What are England playing at? What are England playing at here? Why are they making the wickets not the flattest things in the world? Like, why are England bringing lower teams into the World Cup by making wickets have something in it for the bowlers? I mean, look what happened as well with India, Afghanistan. When you make the wickets a little bit tacky, it brings lower sides into it. You know, India had a close game as well, but England, Sri Lanka, you know, you give Malinga a chance, all of a sudden, England look beatable. I mean, are England's groundsmen going to fuck it up for England is what I'm asking.
Yeah, it looks that way, Higgos. I have no idea why these wickets aren't absolute roads. I mean, the premise is that if you're the home nation, then you get to doctor the wickets, right?
Yes.
Somebody, and please continue with the aggressive correspondence, but I'm sure that the official line is that the ICC prepares the wickets completely independent of England. That'd be the most laughable thing you've ever heard.
Yes.
I can't answer that as well, Higgos. I mean, this is the one thing we are learning about England. I won't say flat track bullies, but if the wickets are flat, very difficult to beat. But because they only have one way of playing, as soon as they get into a bit of trouble or it's difficult for them to hit 500 in the match, they're very susceptible. So, you know, bring on the English weather.
Absolutely.
Well, I think, you know, whatever happens, I think I saw Owen Morgan said that, you know, what they're going to do off the back of this loss is come back and be aggressive, smart and positive. You know, which are three very difficult attributes to exercise in harmony: aggression, intelligence, and positivity. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how they play. So it's Australia versus England. That's the next match for them, isn't it?
That's next match, mate. That's right. Tuesday night, massive game. You know, a lot of people are saying that Dave Warner has been batting, you know, as a warm up for the Ashes. So it's going to be good to see how he goes, especially. But like, I mean, Australia's in this now. Like they are in it. Like, I mean, the games we're going to be talking about here: New Zealand, West Indies, India, Afghanistan, England, Sri Lanka. You know, those involve all the favourites. None of them very convincing. I mean, Australia at least have momentum on their side. Now, if you look at if you look at the odds of who's going to win the World Cup, England's still the favourites, then India, and then Australia. But like, I mean, Australia are in this now. I mean, they've got a squad where I think that on flat wickets, as you're saying, Pez, England are the favourites because they got guys who can score at 120 from ball one, but. On dicey wickets, this is where the more, you know, circumspect batting of a Khawaja, for instance, might come into play. Steve Smith batting at four, it all makes sense now. If the wickets are flat, probably a different story. But I think Australia like riding this competition now all of a sudden, and it's mainly because England are fucking it up.
Do you
it's
think
awesome.
Australia recognise this about, like, you know, the weather, changing weather patterns, you know, Northern Hemisphere cricket, and structured their team accordingly? What I'm saying, do you think that Justin Langer believes in climate change as opposed to David Warner?
Doesn't strike me as a. I don't know. Does Justin strike you as a forward thinker, seeing the future, planning for our children? I'm not sure. What are his thoughts on 2050?
We'd have to ask the media manager Jeremy Arnold about that. Just what's Langer's position on climate change? He's a WA boy. He's a bit of a. He's a John Williamson guy, though, as well, isn't he, Langer? He's a bit of a
That's
hater.
That's true.
He's a WA boy, isn't he? Yeah.
But it is interesting, in this World Cup, it is going to come down to those semi-finals. Like, it comes down to two games, and the top four remains relatively set now. Afghanistan remain the only team who you know, statistically, mathematically, cannot make the finals. But the top four is going to be the top four. So it does come down to those two games. And, like, how much is momentum going to play? You know, if Australia make it to the end with only one or two losses, they're going to be – they'll probably be top of the table for a start. But, I mean, how much is that going to play? You know, if England have lost another game, England's draw now. They've got Australia on Tuesday. They've got New Zealand and India to play. So, I mean, there is also a small possibility that if Sri Lanka beat the West Indies and South Africa, and England lose all three games, and England could actually miss out on the semi-finals, which would be absolutely incredible. Wouldn't do great things for our ticket sales, which is obviously the only reason that we've been pumping up England for a while. But I mean, obviously,
I'm glad you cleared that up.
But I mean, like, how much is, like, you know, momentum going to be important going into those semi-finals, lads?
I don't know.
okay.
I don't know how important. I feel like he goes, it's, you know, as it is with when analysing cricket, like, everything that just happened is essentially what we think will happen next. You know, it's like fourth grade cricket captaincy. Mm-hmm. So now that England have lost, like, oh, well, cat amongst the pigeons now. Yeah, they're in trouble. And then we just keep doing that until England probably make the semi-final and then the final. But, the tournament will start to, like, take some strange shapes now because, like, apart from Australia having already played India, there's now, like, a mini tournament between those top four sides.
Yes.
And it would be, like, it would take some, like, pretty remarkable results to knock England out of that situation. And you're right, I'm only saying these things to boost our ticket sales, particularly in the regional areas, if you are listening. Mm. But yeah, I still suspect, you know, we'll talk about New Zealand, West Indies, you know, that, like, of the four, New Zealand are probably the fourth. But yeah, you know, if they do lose those three games and Sri Lanka can pick up a couple, then, wow, that would be an incredible result.
It was Lasith Malinga, 4 for against England, winning the game there. A couple of huge wickets. That Yorker that he got Butler with, incredible delivery. Probably the most out of shape man ever, but he's deserved it. He's earned the right to, you know, to have you know, the athleticism that he does. How impressed are you with his fitness at the moment?
I know the grainy screenshot that you're referring to, he goes, of Malinga's rig side on. Actually, it was worse than I expected it to be. But I feel like it was might just be a really unflattering angle, just captured at exactly the right moment. And I don't want to rig shame him because, you know, I have problems with my own body at the best of times. And no one should ever do that. But I think it's tremendous that someone with that kind of physique can devastate the, you know, such a highly regarded batting lineup. Can you just imagine facing him, though? Like, I remember towards the end of my career, I really struggled to pick up the ball. Like, I just struggled to focus on the ball. Obviously too busy staring into the bowler's eyes. But like, he releases the ball in front of the umpire's cap. And when he's coming around the wicket, like, he'd be releasing it from fucking mid on, I reckon. Like, that is that is X factor as it comes.
Yeah.
I think the slower balls would be the toughest. Because I struggle to pick up the ball as well, which I just put down to red-green colour blindness, which is just more of a function of making excuses that I can't control. That's a separate issue that I'll talk to my counsellor about. But the slower balls have been the most difficult because for a moment you'd think they're about to hit your face.
Oh, yeah.
And then they'd drop at your toes.
Deeply arching parabola. Like, you would see it coming towards your face and then, just inverse exponentials out of your eye line and you're screwed. It's a Yorker that does you. I reckon if I've said this about Boomer as well, but, like, Malinga, if he went through the Cricket Australia Academy, he would have just been identified and then just turned into a Brett Lee clone. Just arms pumping, high knees, elbow up, all straight lines, just going forward, seam in front of his face during the gather. Just, you wouldn't get that X factor, would you, in Australia? It's hard to find a good X factor in Australia.
I know that previously batsmen, when facing Malinga, have asked the umpire to take his cap off because I think at one point definitely the umpires used to wear white caps during the ODIs for some reason. But have you seen in this World Cup, I think is it Bruce Oxenford who's got like that like arm guard circular glass barrier thing that he has he's protecting his face with?
Do you reckon there's like some kind of stigma among umpires if you kid up, like, you know, when you wear a chest guard or an arm guard when you're batting, you're kind of sometimes perceived as a bit soft?
Yes.
Do you reckon if you're an umpire rocking some kind of protective garment, there's a bit of status among the umpires?
Possibly. I mean, I grew up in Australia, obviously, like, you had your icons of, like, Dean Jones batting the cap, you know, Madras or whatever. You know, Michael Clarke, when he got his first century in India there, he was facing Zahir Khan, and he was like, no, I'm going to score my first test century wearing a baggy green. It might be the same with umpires, like, because you see umpires from time to time, even in club cricket now, you see umpires wearing helmets because they want to protect their head, which is a really smart thing to do. But it's not cool. And as we know, umpires are the coolest people on the field. So, there probably is a hierarchy there. Let's move on to India-Afghanistan. Mohammad Shami took a hat-trick in what ended up to be the final over to rescue India from, would we say, humiliation by defeat against Afghanistan? Would we go that far?
Yes, he did, though they needed sort of 13 or so off the last over, so I think they were just about home. It was more of an icing kind of situation, but... it was quite phenomenal watching that match. A friend of the show, Ben Jones, put it really well when he said the World Cup has roared to life. I actually don't think he said that, but he said, you're not going well when India and Afghanistan was the worst match of the day. They won by 11 runs, and it was really phenomenal watching it because that Indian crowd is just so passionate. And so loud, like it comes through the speakers, you know, just with like so much intensity. It made me wonder, like, what an Australian crowd would be like were it like just scraping home against Afghanistan. Like, every wicket was just roared and met with like just World Cup winning fever. It'd be kind of good.
It would be. I mean, there was actually in that England Sri Lanka game at Headingley there, when Ben Stokes was batting in the end and it looked like he might be getting them home, there were like some guttural roars. Like, it was just, had me buying in. I bought in heavily. I want to ask you this. Mohammad Shami took a hat trick. Does that hat trick count, given it was against the tail and they were all slogging to try and hit sixes to win the game? Does that hat trick count?
That's troubling to me that we have to ask whether hat tricks count or don't count.
It's a post-truth society.
Well, exactly. I mean, Trump ruined everything for everyone. Look, no, it doesn't count, he goes. It doesn't count because it was the final over. They were hitting out. Tell me this. How were all the wickets taken? Were they
caught it long on,
right?
Bowled. And bowled, yeah.
Oh, there's two bowls in there.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's a hat trick. Well, it's a World Cup hat trick, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a World Cup
match. It sounds like you might have a view on that.
Well, I'm glad you asked, Pez. I think it might have been Dan Christian who got one at in Hobart, and it was like the final over, and like all were like caught on the boundary. There might have been like a full toss in there, like leg side hacking, and it was like technically 3 wickets and 3 balls. So like he completed an international one day hat trick, which I actually have never done. I know a lot of people out there think that I have, but I actually have never got one of those. But it's just, I don't know. There are hat tricks and hat tricks, you know. So
Proliferation of cricket, you know, across all forms, there are more hat tricks, and hat tricks need to be specified. You know, maybe there are some tiers of hat tricks that we need to introduce, or some hat tricks mean more than others, of course.
Mm. Like, you know how Merv Hughes got his hat trick, but it was over like 2 innings, so that's kind of confusing.
Wasn't it over 2 matches? Or was it actually just over 2 minutes?
No, it was the same game.
Oh, it was the same
two
game.
2 matches.
Does it count if you get a... No, it wouldn't. Would it? Why would it?
No, it doesn't count. I like the idea, though. I like to expand the idea of the hat-trick. I'm just a big fan of people taking balls home and then mounting them, just in general, training balls. And, you know, one guy who would hit a clean training ball, I don't know how many training balls he's lost in his entire life, but Carlos Brathwaite. I think we've seen the best 100 of the World Cup so far. Let's move on to New Zealand and the West Indies, because, you know, we've got no fans in India, so what's the point? New Zealand and West Indies. What an unbelievable game of cricket. Carlos Braithwaite, like, that is going to be the best 100 you'll see this World Cup. That was incredible. Still lost, but, you know, satisfaction for him.
Better.
Yeah, it was an incredible ton. I mean, for Kane Williamson's ton as well in the first innings in a much more controlled manner. Just, what did someone call him? The freckled Dravid.
Yes.
He just ploughs on. I feel like with New Zealand, it's kind of, like, do we... as Australians, worry about New Zealand at all, or do we just worry about Kane Williamson? For starters,
I reckon that the Kiwis are kind of like a small market NBA franchise, like kind of like San Antonio under Greg Popovich, just really well coached, well drilled, cohesive unit, just all play for each other, no egos. They don't get as much media as like the big market franchises, like. Like India's like the Lakers, Australia's like the Knicks, but they just use their resources so well. New Zealand produce one or two franchise players. I mean, Kane Williamson's obviously a franchise player, and just build teams around them.
Guys, I don't know if you caught this on the stump mic, but Jimmy Neesham, who was bowling the second last over, he actually swore into the stump microphone, and he said, "For fuck's sake," at one of his teammates. So are we being led on by how nice and, you know, uncompetitive this New Zealand team are?
Like, when I watched New Zealand play, and I heard that as well, he said, like Brathwaite brought up his ton, and Neesham was blowing up because the guy at Cow, he sort of ran a two, and the guy at Cow, who picked it up, threw it to the keeper's end when there was probably a chance at the bowler's end, and Neesham said, fucking hell. And it made me think, like, while Australia does tend to beat New Zealand in cricket, like, they would be so much funnier than our side, you know, which is kind of alpha in its own way. What was your question again?
Are New Zealand going to win the World Cup?
No. New Zealand always seem to make a pretty good run in the World Cup. Then they're always the bright, vibrant side that you hope to do well, and they never do. So, I'm just happy to say here, just to add more egg to my face already, no, New Zealand won't win the World Cup.
Or the Rugby World Cup, they will. Italy are going to win that this year. Edo's, how would you fancy bowling to Carlos Braithwaite in the nets?
Fuck. Firstly, what a name that is. Like,
there is an alternation between Brathwaite and Braithwaite going on. Like, yeah, Darryl's brother.
Is it Brathwaite? It's Brathwaite, isn't it?
It's Brath, I think I've heard.
I wish it was Braithwaite. Either way, it's great. I mean, he's seriously... I don't know how tall is he. He's like 7'8". Like, he looks so fucking big. Like, he's an absolute beast of a man. Only bowls 120 though, but an absolute beast of a man. No, I wouldn't want to bowl to him in the nets. He goes, I'll definitely slide over to the third net and bowl my left arm off his like I used to, even though I'm a right hander. Just for the fuck of it.
There's definitely a thing going on with the West Indies as well. I mean, Kieran Pollard used to do this as well, or Kyron Pollard used to do that as well, just bat with massive watches on. I'm not sure how I feel about it. Baby G watches. You know, we've seen it was Mkhwazi Field and one of those things. I'm not quite sure about it just yet. But, you know, that's because I want everyone to do exactly the same thing at all times. Australia-England, boys, Tuesday night. This is that's a game. That's a game of cricket, that is. Any thoughts leading into that one?
Well, I thought that Australia... No, not really, mate. I thought Australia might have been tempted to rest a few guys heading into the match. Why would you bowl Stark? What's that, mate?
Just play with six.
Play with six.
yeah. But, yeah, maybe, you know, why would you show them Stark if he's going to be so important to them later? But now they're kind of obligated to try and, like, really beat England and put them under pressure in terms of remaining in the tournament.
So you're saying there's, like, two ways of playing this, like, deliberately pick a lesser side so not to show them your best and then maybe risk losing that and all the associated capital, or to just fucking annihilate them and send a real message. Two options. It's a binary
messages
world.
Must be sent. You always want to send a message. Yeah. Messages must be sent, you know, when it comes to winning games. But they're playing at Lord's. I think a lot of it will come down to the wicket. Because we said when England lost to Pakistan, well, that was the loss they needed to have. But now they've sort of gone, their batters have failed again. The big one will be whether Jason Roy comes back in time. It's 50-50, as I understand it, because James Vince at the top of the order is great for a couple of cover drives, and they are great cover drives. And then he just loves nicking off or getting out in some way. So
he might be my favourite player, actually, for 15 minutes, just for like 15 minutes at a turn. Nice to see a game being played at Lord's as well, because I can recognise, just homeliness. Let me put a scenario in your heads here, lads. So England, Australia, Tuesday night. Now, if Australia win that game, England are going to remain on 8 competition points. Now, Sri Lanka are on 6, 6 points. Now, Sri Lanka play against South Africa on Friday. So come the weekend, there is a possibility... I didn't think this was going to happen, but there is a possibility that Sri Lanka and England are on the same amount of points with 2 games to play, and England have to play India and New Zealand to come. That's, this is fucking mouthwatering. Like, this is, England will go into the Australia game as favourites. Mm-hmm. Not by a lot, but they'll be favourites. But I just think, like, Australia couldn't have come across England at a better time. Like, there's just, now there's questions being asked. Mm. How the fuck is Dave Warner going to hold back? Like, this is, like, we're going to get a different version of David. He's going to come out fresh-faced. He's going to score 200 off 80 balls. Like, it's all coming together.
This is a thing, mate. Like, you know, you got idiots like me on the cast in the last week or so just saying, look, you need to understand, you know, we haven't been paying attention to England here because we're a myopic country. They've been winning 70% of their matches. Mm-hmm. They're knocking on the door of 400. Mm-hmm. They have 4 guys that, you know, score 60 or 40 balls. We're still concerned with milestones. We're playing an outdated form of cricket. Maybe just Vish was right on the show. Just the image of Ponting on the balcony changes everything. Who cares if they've rewritten the rules of one day cricket, you know, through great investment in Loughborough and revolutionising the game through Australia's own Trevor Bayliss. You know, one look at Ponting and that conservative style of cricket from, you know, 2000 to 2009 sends them all buckling. Could be right.
Edos, I want to throw to you and I want to ask you, like, how satisfying you finding that, like, before the tournament there was a chat, and even Will McPherson came on the podcast and he said he'd be surprised if, like, someone didn't score 500 this tournament. Leading into the World Cup, England were just chasing 500. That was all the chat, all the talk. Couldn't chase down 230 against Sri Lanka. I mean, how much satisfaction are you deriving from this?
A considerable volume of satisfaction, he goes, is being derived from this, to answer your question specifically.
Can you describe how that satisfaction is manifesting, Dan?
Yes.
Just from the fact that they're not getting 500. Like, how satisfied are you?
Yeah. After, like, 15 overs and they're only going at sixes, not tens. Yeah. Like, what's your reaction?
But I'm sort of, like, walking around at work and stuff. And
visibly shaking. Like, I can feel my temperature rising. A little cold sweats breaking out. Just, I'm overwhelmed, really, emotionally and physically by it. I think what you're saying, Pez, is interesting. You know, maybe run scoring and the way cricket is played is cyclical. Maybe we are going back to a conservative style of cricket, much like, you know, conservative politics is now in vogue. Is everything... Look, because you can't just go to 400, then 500. Like, where does it end? Like, are we, 100 years from now, going to be scoring at 50 and over? Like we're obviously that's possibly given it 6 balls. Obviously there'll need to be 12 balls and over, which will happen because you need to create new rules to accommodate progress of humankind. But where does it end? I mean, are we going to be in the year 2050? Is a 50 over going to amount to 220 runs, like, you know, Jeff Marsh anchoring in innings and getting 56 off 120? Like, I want that. It won't happen, but I want that.
I think that wickets will become outdated and every ball will be a free hit. And when one team wins the toss, they just bat until everyone just goes home.
Do you reckon we'll play on AstroTurf, like, you know, in the NFL?
Oh, definitely.
It'll be T-ball on AstroTurf is the end game for cricket.
T-ball.
But, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, there'll be obviously there's a clamour for, you know, real estate all across, you know, most continents. The exacerbation of global warming means the grass will die. So it'll all be AstroTurf.
High-rise, high-density apartments, yeah.
Yep. So that's the future. And those are our insights into Australia and England on Tuesday night. All right, let's get Mark Butcher on the phone. And then after that, hashtag AskTGC.
Cool, okay.
You're recording here, guys?
Ready to go, mate. Yep, all good.
Okay, boys. Ahead of the blockbuster England v Australia fixture, we thought, well, the great cricketer will settle for nothing less than an England Test captain. With 3 of his 8 Test tons coming against Australia, and as we learnt during our last chat with him, he's an expert on the myth of Australian exceptionalism. He's a Surrey legend, a familiar face for England through the late 90s and early 90s, and he has a new album coming out, which we're going to talk about too. I'm talking about Mark Butcher. Butch, welcome to the Grad Cricketer.
All right, thanks, gents. Another cracking introduction. Thank you.
let me just dive right in, Butch. As you'd know, you know, we're just a little country in the corner of the world who rightly lives through the prism of 1999 for all sorts of complex political and cultural reasons. As a result, there's a large expectation that despite statistics to the contrary, Australia will beat England in this World Cup because, well, it's England. This podcast has made the mistake of trying to strip that back and explain to the audience that England are actually quite good and Australia are possibly flattering to deceive. We've been playfully criticised for doing so, though is it playful? Never sure. What do you say to the Australians listening out there who think they're likely to win by reasons of birthright aura, mythological exceptionalism, and because Ricky Ponting is on camera all the time?
what I say to them is that whatever sort of misplaced belief they might have come into the tournament with, that would surely be the case, suddenly now looks absolutely justified, and I can't knock them out of their stride. I mean, how have we lost to Sri Lanka? I watched Sri Lanka play in the year leading up to the match the other night, and they were without any question the worst team that I'd seen over that period. So the favourites and hosts have ended up losing to them, and ended up losing to them reasonably comfortably. So I'm just back in the late 90s again, and I've got migraines, and nothing is right in the world.
Well, yeah, that's the late 90s to you, whereas the late 90s to us is just utopia.
I mean, just on that, Butch, like, I mean, what do you, with that in mind, like, what do you make of this Australian side? Like, there's a school of thought that they're a couple of years behind India and England when it comes to the way they play their ODI cricket, but then in the context of this tournament, pitches have been tricky, scores are low, they now sort of look quite strong. Where do you pitch them? And also, I guess the same question in relation to England as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, what's been going on in terms of the narrative for 50-over cricket for the last 2 years, in this country anyway, I don't know about Australia, has been that all of this run scoring and you know, record breaking and six hitting is incredibly bad, you know, because who wants to be entertained by people scoring runs and hitting the ball out the park and breaking records when you can have medium pacers getting away with 10 overs and under 35. So that has been the narrative leading up to the tournament, right? And then all of a sudden, what's happened is you put a bit of pressure into the game, i.e. points involved because it's a World Cup. All of a sudden, the game doesn't appear to have changed that much. You know, chasing down totals now looks nigh on impossible, no matter how many runs it is, whether it's a big total or a small one. You know, the batters become paralysed by scoring rates up above seven. You know, the game almost appears to be exactly the same one that we've always watched, but just people getting overexcited about the idea that every once in a while, and given a new sort of attitude to the idea of hitting the ball, that it isn't a bad thing to have the ball go sailing out of the park every once in a while. You know, the game is the game. Sometimes the bowlers are on top, sometimes the batters are on top, and then in the perfect world, you end up with a game where 310 plays 310, it goes down to the last over with a wicket in hand. You know, and the game has always been that way. The amount of runs scored or not don't constitute whether it's been a good game or a bad one. So I got that rant out of the way. But going back to your more specific point about the Australian team, the frightening thing is, and this was always going to be the case going into it, was that no matter what problems they were having in terms of deciding what their best lineup was, you know, leaving out Josh Hazlewood for crying out loud. I mean, there's a guy who's very unlucky to be on the outside. But Australia haven't, you know, apart from playing against India, haven't lost a game yet, and they haven't really been at their best either. So it turns out that winning four out of the last five World Cups actually means something, you know, in terms of the pressure of coping with tournament play. And Australia seemed to have that cracked once again, which is bloody annoying.
Well, just on that, Butch, I mean, you spoke there about, like, the pressure of chasing and going at seven and over and stuff like that. I mean, England have lost both their games chasing, which is something they've set about doing for the last couple of years. I mean, do you think there'll be any sort of change in tactic with England? Do you think they'll, you know, think about, you know, batting first at all, especially like with the wickets not being as flat as what, you know, many perceive they might be? But, you know, do you think England might, you know, change a tactic?
Yeah, it's a possibility that they will. You know, I've kind of never really, again, never bought into the idea that chasing runs was incredibly easy. And again, it just goes back to the idea of pressure. Bilateral series, when you've got, you know, potentially five games or whatever, it kind of doesn't matter if you lose. And so chasing becomes a lot easier.
Yeah.
As soon as you stick 2 points on it and a place in the semi-final, the chase becomes more difficult.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are. And all of the teams have found that, haven't they? You know, we've seen the only really good chase we've seen is Bangladesh beating the short ball against the West Indies the other day when they chased 300 odd. And that was quite stunning. But something that has been absolutely the norm in the lead up to the World Cup has now suddenly disappeared. The idea that chasing runs is straightforward. So yeah, I mean, England would definitely have thought about that.
Yeah, Butch, England now actually have a slim mathematical chance of completely missing the semis. I think.
Let's stop it.
Unbelievable. I don't have a question.
No, my daughter's just come in to save me from this conversation. Like, hey, Indy boy.
Anyway, with that in mind, your album, which we touched on at the start of the chat, I think that's due to come out July 9. I think the semis are due around July 5. Will you try and rush through the release of new album before England's inevitable demise?
Well, I'm getting out on the 5th. Thank you very much. Yeah, 5th of July. So it'll be before the semi-final places are finally decided, I guess.
Right. Is that a deliberate tactic from your record label or yourself?
For the purposes of the podcast, yes, it is. Yeah,
okay.
But no, I hadn't really factored it in. It's been 9 years since I released the last one, so we weren't nickpicking over to that extent to get this one out.
Which I hadn't actually sort of pre-prepared this question, but like I lived in the UK the last couple of years, and I thought I observed through the national football side in the World Cup, they had kind of transcended the stereotype of the England side that kind of fails expectations, you know, during world tournaments. I sort of observed that the cricket side as well is playing in, you know, up until this point has played in a manner very different to the way we've understood England cricket sides to play. And yet whenever we talk to journos or friends or people on the cast, there's always that kind of like below the line cynicism about, oh, look, you know, we might lose in a semi to Australia. I mean, is that a real thing with this England side? I mean, I know it's one thing for the public to sort of say that as a coping mechanism, but do you think Trevor Bayliss's side would actually be feeling the pressure, or do you think they're not scared of Australia and they're just going to play their own game?
Yeah, I don't think they'll be overly concerned, but I don't think that there's any way, shape, or form that the camp can't have suddenly had, a bit of a huge chunk of their armour peeled off losing that game to Sri Lanka the other day, because that's just the result that shouldn't have happened. You know, given everything that has gone into the tournament from both teams, England should not have lost a World Cup match to Sri Lanka. And so, therefore, you know, there's a little bit of a nudge in the confidence has got to have happened. And, of course, because of that, the expectation, well, not the expectation, but the pressure then rises, doesn't it? Because the team themselves, I think, quite rightly, I have absolutely no qualms. I'm going to be very, very un-English about this. I have no qualms about saying that this team believed that they were the business and that they were going to win the World Cup. Because, frankly, they have played everybody off the park in the last 3.5 years, and I don't think there's any sort of hyperbole in saying that. However, you know, in my gig as you know, sort of talking nonsense about the game for a living, I've said that the one thing that I have seen England do in virtually all of these series, apart from the 5-0 drubbings of Australia that have gone on twice home and away. Have been that we have the potential to play an absolute stinker of a game, whether it counts or not, that there is that potential in there in virtually every series that we've played. And we've seen two of them in this tournament so far. I mean, the Pakistan, I mean, they should have chased down that 304, whatever it was, 340 against Pakistan, but they shouldn't have been chasing that many. They fielded terribly in that game. And allowed sort of Pakistan's bowlers to come in and do what they do best when there's a big run chase on. And as I said, the Sri Lanka game is an absolute shocker to lose to them. So yeah, I mean it's going to be tough watching from now on, and we'll find out what they're all about. They've been able to bully teams, they've been able to smash teams off the park. They've also got, you know, in Jofra Archer and Mark Wood, two weapons they didn't have. Leading into the World Cup. So potentially they're a better side than they've been. However, they just haven't been able to sort of keep their nerve and win the tight ones when they've come along.
Do you think the loss of Jason Roybutch seems even more significant than what otherwise might have been? I mean, we saw James Vince come into the side. We were talking earlier in the show that, you know, he played that sumptuous off drive against Malinga, flick off the pads, just looking amazing for 20 and then scratched off. I mean, you know, Jason Roy's got some talk about coming to the test side as well. So, you know, he wasn't really required in the Afghanistan game because Owen Morgan, you know, got a nice looking 148. But I mean, are we seeing how important Jason Roy is to the team?
Oh yeah, I mean the partnership between himself and Johnny. I mean Johnny Bairstow's made two golden ducks in the tournament so far, and Jason has obviously missed a couple of matches. Now those two have been, you know, generally speaking, in the run chase scenario, if England were chasing 330, 340, 350 even, those two would scratch off more than half of the run chase before you got to the 20th over, and it's kind of done then, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so therefore the you know, therefore, their partnership at the top has been a huge part of why England have been so successful. And so both of them failing, or one of them not even being on the park, is huge. Yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, expecting... And I'm also guessing that sort of Josh Butler has been amazing at times. But expecting the others to kind of to keep picking up the slack and score at that sort of rate... you know, or score at a higher rate than they've had to in the past because of the fact that the openers have got the thing down to something manageable, has proved a little bit too difficult for the middle order. And another thing that I've noticed is that Liam Plunkett has the two games that Liam Plunkett hasn't played in, England have lost. And he, regardless of the job that the other bowlers have been able to do to sort of to cope with his expertise through the middle period of the innings, what they haven't been able to do is replace his hitting down the order. I mean, he's an incredible batter to have coming in at number 10 or something. And both of the games where they failed to get over the line, they kind of run out of, they just haven't had the quality of player as deep as he might normally have given them the option. So that's another thing for them to think about.
Butch, as you know, as we've mentioned at the top of the show, you have an album coming out. It's called Now Playing. It's out on the 5th of July, as you said. We're going to play your single as well at the end of this interview, but we still have a few questions left. Just to connect it with cricket, how do you find your and it's a proper album, you're a genuine musician in your own right. You know, how do you find your music skills, creativity and performances, you know, are received by other cricketers? I mean, are people generally admiring it in England, or are there sports jocks quick to cast you as a rare unit for enjoying the humanities?
maybe there might be a few. I mean, it's not, we don't have quite the same sort of sneering attitude to the arts in this country as you guys do over there. So, it's all okay. Generally speaking, people are pretty supportive actually. Mm. When it comes down to it, and the only thing that I have any interest in really is if the stuff stands up of its own right. I mean, in many ways, I think the fact that I used to play is a touch of a hindrance, or it feels like a touch of a hindrance to me, because I've kind of got I'd almost like to change my name and see if people could, people would then view it in a more impartial way. But generally speaking, it's pretty good. I don't get too much flack for it.
Butch, can you give us your...
feel free to go and attend to your young child.
She's okay. She's just destroying my CD collection. She's all good. She's fine.
Okay. All right. I noticed recently that Joe Root played guitar in the sheds after, I think it was when England beat Sri Lanka 3-0. Did you see that video? Yeah. Amateur hour?
I didn't see it, but I have spoken to Joe. Joe came up, as an England captain should do, just prior to the toss of an important one-day international in Sri Lanka, to ask me about the best ways to sort of learn how to play songs and to improve his guitar playing technique. So Joe's all over it.
So he's early on in his guitar playing journey.
Indeed, yeah. He's got one of those little Ed Sheeran Martins. I mean, the Martin Guitar Company in the States has made an enormous amount of money out of that little guitar, because after cricketers that are trying to play have got one. I think Dale Steyn's got one and all that kind of stuff. So there's a few of the guys that carry them about. And it's a brilliant thing to do when you're on tour. I mean, notwithstanding the extra luggage that the boards have to pay for. But it's a good thing to, for guys to have.
I think I saw that Steve Smith actually brought his guitar on tour, which I just can't visualize playing acoustic guitar like at the back of the bus. I just cannot visualize it.
Mm. Yeah, well, Shane Watson, obviously, more famously, Brett Lee. There's a lot of players, and it's totally understandable. It's a portable thing, carry it around, sit in your room, play with yourself, perfect for touring.
Which a lyric from the single Country, which Pez said before we'll play in a moment's time, a lyric caught my ear. So I paid you all my money, and when you cry I pay some more, but if you hide me from my children, there's nothing worth my slaving for. Now, I just want to know, is this a song secretly about not paying your fees to an emotional club secretary and being away from your friends and family on weekends while doing fine leg to fine leg?
It's almost exactly that. Mate, my time at South Melbourne has burnt a deep scar into my psyche. So yeah, that's exactly what it is.
I thought so. Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
Obvious, really.
Yeah. There's a recent feature in Wisden where you said your number one guest at a test match would be Jimi Hendrix, and I heard you talking about this the other day on their podcast as well. Wanted to ask, as an artist, What sort of cricketer do you think he would have been? Sort of left arm fast or something a little more nuanced in Test cricket terms?
I think he would have been a mystery spinner without any doubt whatsoever. Mm. He'd have been tying people up in knots. You wouldn't have been able to tell whether there was any sort of kink in his elbow. and people would have sort of shied away from making that call about him.
Yeah.
It would have been one of those that you sort of think, well, yeah, we think he probably bungs it, but we're not going to pull him up on it because the magic is just too great. It's too strong.
That spell against the Aussies was like Woodstock 69.
Butcher, have you heard the Barmy Army song Cricket's Coming Home?
Oh, have I heard it? I'm bloody in it.
Yeah.
I got horribly, horribly rinsed on that. Rod Bransgrove is a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
The sort of impresario of Hampshire cricket, and he said, do you mind doing this thing? We're doing the song. And I said, oh, okay. I couldn't really say no because he's a mate.
Yeah.
But he also said, we're getting getting loads of guys to do it. You'll probably only be in it for 2 seconds or whatever. But all of the players are going to be involved. And there's like three of us, and one of them, Charlotte Edwards. I think, so I've not even watched it. I'm pretty appalled with my judgment about saying yes on it.
Well, I obviously was going to say something else, but now I'm realising you're in it. I just got to say, I think it's fantastic. Love what you're doing.
Which time signatures do you favour when singing the club song naked after a game? Traditional 4-4 or something a little more unusual? Maybe a 3-4 or even a 7-4?
Yeah. I mean, that's a real tough one. 6-8 tends to sort of bend people's minds a little bit after a game, especially if you're a couple of VBs in. So, I think it's much easier to slam the toe of your bat into Slobian. The concrete floor at 4-4 and just, just hammer it out.
Yeah. Well, I think we just found the quote for our show. Bush, why don't you tell us, as we exit this, a little bit about the album's called Now Playing and maybe a little bit about the single that we're going to hear as well.
The single is about the idea of something that you guys are encountering quite a bit in Australia and have done forever, really. It's about the idea of people finding themselves generations down the line still being asked the question, no, but where are you really from? Like my mum was born of Jamaican grandparents. They came over in the Windrush in the 50s, and she was born in Camberwell, South London, but people would say, so where are you from? She'd say, well, London. And they go, yeah, but where are you really from? And that kind of thing is still happening now, generations and generations down the line. So that's what that's about. And it's got a proper thumping old beat to it, and I hope people enjoy it. And the album itself is just, I tried to write a bunch of 3.5 minute pop rock songs that had everything in them that you could chuck in, but not sort of overstay their welcome, I guess. And I think we managed to succeed to do that.
Nice one. Mark Butcher, thanks for joining us and enduring those questions. I hope they were the strangest you'll encounter while you publicise the album and talk about the cricket. The album is called Now Playing. It's out on the 5th of July, coinciding with the semi-finals of the World Cup. And the single's called Country. We're going to hear it now.
I wasn't trained next to
lot of surprises in the World Cup. Dave, and here goes. What would be for sure is that Lasith Malinga wears Budgie Smugglers. Would he not? I mean, beneath that beautifully protruding belly that we saw in that grainy image, without doubt would have been Team Sri Lanka Budgie Smugglers.
Oh, absolutely, mate. I thought that I could catch a glimpse of Nathan Lyon's bald head just under his pants, under those purple pants. Pretty sure I saw him in a pair of budgies.
Well, we saw before the World Cup when Australia played against Sri Lanka in that warm-up game that after the game he was helping Stoinis with his slow ball. So we know that Lasith is very friendly with the Australian team, so why not celebrate, by having, Australia's greatest ever finger spinner, tucked down below?
Which is our way of saying the way to celebrate your own friendliness or Lasith Malinga's friendliness is by purchasing a pair of Budgie Smugglers.
Yes.
You might dispute the logic of what I've just said. That's up to you. Aggressively write to us about it. Budgiesmuggler.com.au.
Hashtag AskTGC, boys. Here we go. Sam Owen, right at the top. He says, "Hey, fellas, avid listener here. Relates to life on many fronts. This is a question / advice. With you guys openly advertising your shows in England, I'm just wondering what visa you guys have, for payments, etc. You may or may not be aware that in England, when clubs engage with an overseas pro or amateur, they then advertise on Twitter that they can coach, etc., for X amount. Then rival clubs will tag HMRC in the tweet to make them aware of the club's sometimes illegal ongoings, etc. Just wondering if you guys have the correct visas in place. I'd hate to see the likes of Joe Harmon at Wisden, The Final Word, or TMS Podcast tweeting HMRC about your shows and grassing you in, etc. Or do you have like a deal with Yaz Rana or Dan Norcross to pay the money into their accounts and then they give you the cash? Or is it cashiers on the door? I reckon if that's the case, your best bet would be Tuffers to sort the account stuff with from the podcast world, as you could meet him down the pub and sort a deal, or I could put you in touch with the Fast Lads from my club, a self-made group from our club with an array of parent supporters, lower league cricketers, that can help you out. We have a CEO and everything and can help you on any dodgy fronts. Either way, I don't want you guys getting done over, as the podcast is too good. Keep up the good work." That's from Sam, who has our best interests at heart, clearly.
I appreciate that, Sam. Nice extrapolation from the experiences of many club cricketers going overseas, or to any club really, where you just kind of, like, any change of club or international movement, like, results in running the gauntlet of, like, mafioso underground kind of dealings. And Sam, I guess, is saying essentially, come and play at my club.
Yeah, I think it's good. I mean, I assume it's the same in England with the HMRC, but the ATO always kind of announces the things that they're going to be looking out for in this year's kind of tax return, any kind of dodgy things, to be on the lookout for that. So I assume that, the HMRC this summer is going to pay close attention to travelling podcast trios such as The Great Cricketer. So it's a good thing that we're in good hands there. It's all legit. It's all above board, I can say, although if you want to slip a 50 in our pockets, we will take it.
I wonder what's going to happen with Brexit and stuff for, like, overseas cricketers. Because, I mean, as you guys know, I did that for 3 years over in the UK. Had to get a visa a couple of years. The first year I went over illegally. Happy to announce that in the podcast. I'm sure there'll be no repercussions
just
from
before
that.
Before we go to the UK.
Yep. And then had a visa the second time. But, yeah, I mean, it's, like, really hard now. They've made, like, heaps of red tape and stuff for, like, overseas pros and stuff to go and play at clubs. It's, like, it's much more difficult than it used to be. Anyway, I'll be going to jail, so good luck with the shows in the UK, boys. Bobby Boucher writes in. He says, "Hashtag AskTGC, and I promise there is a question in here somewhere. I'm a high school teacher and was using the 1 metre rule to shadow bat in class not too long ago. After I played a convincing punch through cover for a couple to open my account, I flicked one off my pads, and the bowler very quickly worked out I was strong on the front foot. The next ball was short and at the body, so I flicked it off my hip and turned for a single. As I looked up, I was met by the eyes of one of my students, whom I also coached at junior level. Without hesitation, he stated, 'Leading edge back to the bowler, you're gone,' just like on Saturday. The class erupted and I had no comeback.
Not only can I not even make a run shadow batting, the boys I coach are well aware of my career average being a tick over 15 and clearly not rating me as a cricketer at all. I know Higos often offers the advice of quit cricket and get huge, but I am 5'9" on a good day and have never weighed more than 75 kilos, whether I'm in shape or not, so there's no chance of getting huge. Also, cricket offers one point of contact with my father, who last season drove 600 kilometres to watch me play in a grand final. So, if I quit cricket, I'll not only have a below average rig and a career average of 15.2, I could potentially, most definitely, lose the little respect my father has for me after he witnessed my after he witnessed me kick a half volley twice in that grand final that sparked a collapse of 10 for 38 to see us all out for 68 chasing 96. Please help. What should I do? Also, can't wait to see the Birmingham show.
What, how do you kick there? A half volley twice?
Does that mean he was out twice? Like they got no, there was just a one innings game.
Yeah, maybe the first one was given not out because the umpire thought, well, I'll give you a reprieve here.
Right.
I don't know.
If there's traditionally low scores, you know, 68 chasing 96, and he averages 15.2, it's actually not a bad average.
It's not bad.
That's what stuck out to me.
Well, he's obviously opening the batting as well.
A 1 meter ruler. Yeah, one of those wooden ones, I'm presuming.
Yeah.
What do we suggest here? As you said, yeah, quitting is not an option and improving his physique is not an option. Is there any, like, quit your job? Stop being a teacher?
Quit something.
Find a new industry?
I think his father driving 600 kilometres to watch him play in a grand final now.
Yeah.
It's nice that he's put that in kilometres as well because clearly he's playing in the UK.
He said kilograms right? as well.
I can't wait to
kilograms.
See Birmingham shows. So he's converted from imperial measurements for us. And 600Ks from Birmingham, presumably, that's Scotland, isn't it?
I think this guy's in Portugal.
This guy's his dad's driven across international borders to watch him play cricket.
So he can't quit.
That's a lot of fucking details.
Don't quit. I kicked a half volley twice. I'm just imagining like he's like keepy uppy with the ball. He was bowled at his, yeah. I don't know.
All right. Big Al.
let me storm in with Big Al here. I was just trying to make something happen. Big Al. Hi, DGC. Love your show. Recently, Icelandic cricket, a nation of comparable cricketing ability to fellow minnows Nepal and South Africa, took to social media to congratulate Rashid Khan on an exemplary century. To contextualise that particular circuit, Khan's 100 was off his own bowling, producing unflattering figures of 9 overs, 0 maidens, none for 110. A jibe that would have drawn rapturous applause if posted from TGC instead included friends of the show amongst its harshest critics, as if collectively decrying associate nations' attempts at participating in the so-called World Cup. While long-winded, ultimately my question is a simple yes-no. I wear a single compression arm sleeve despite running the 100 metres in 13.8 seconds and last having tendonitis in my elbow as a virile teenager in the late noughties. My club is hosting its AGM next week and I have been encouraged to stand for president. Thoughts?
Well, first of all, having a compression, single arm compression, in the same mold as like Allen Iverson or something, you know, from the you know, early 2000 NBA days, great way to boost your athleticism aesthetically. Of course, that won't change the fact that you're running a 14 second 100 metres. So keep that up. I love all that. Love that you've got tendonitis in your elbow. I like that joke there, another wanking joke on the podcast. Terrific stuff. Don't stand for president. Nothing good comes from that. And Rashid Khan, yeah. I mean, Rashid Khan's been disappointing for me. I mean, I know that's not what his question is. I don't know, he just wanted to sledge Nepal and South Africa in the same sentence. So that's good stuff. Don't stand for president. Probably leave the club. And keep up the compression arm stuff. Good, yeah, it's good around.
Well, I'll just move along then. Okay, so this one, they've asked to keep their name anonymous. So here goes. Last weekend, I played a Middlesex Premier League fixture for my club side. He then provides a link to the scorecard. Amongst my 11 was former England Test batsman Mark Ramprakash, 35,659 first-class runs at 53.14 with 114 centuries. Oh, my fuck. We were put into the field in the first innings and quickly realised that this wasn't a bad thing, as the wicket was horrendous. For the seamers, it was slow and very up and down. For the spinners, the odd one would roll and some would turn 17 metres. Anyway, we bowled the other team out for 161 in 49.2 overs. Ramps, I believe, requested to bat 5 in the chase, so we made room for him there. One of our openers fell early, as did our number 3 and 4. The other opener took the live-by-the-sword, die-by-the-sword approach and tried to slog us to the total, being dropped 76 times on his way to 77. Meanwhile, Ramps at the other end made it look as though the wicket was flat as anything and mixed intelligent accumulation with sumptuous maximums down the ground off their spinners. He finished 55 not out, barely mishitting a single ball on a wicket that nobody else looked the slightest bit fluent on. Ramps is almost 50 years old. Our other batsmen are in their 20s. How depressing is it that a 50-year-old is still so much better than all of us, despite not having played the game anymore? To top it off, in the changing room after the game, when congratulated on his innings and asked whether he enjoyed it, Ramps raised his eyebrows, sighed, and said, "It was decent exercise. Fucking hell, the rest of us would have killed to play in an innings like that," and his highlight was running between the wickets. Oh, and by the way, he batted with no lid or cap and his salad looked brilliant. Not sure what the question is, but despite us 20-something-year-olds having been able to watch a batting masterclass, we're all left feeling a little flat, having been shown quite how far away we are from actually being good. Thoughts? A lot of questions end with just thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, I don't know why he wants to be anonymous. He's just appreciating Mark Ramprakash, who he played with in a game of cricket. Like, I don't know why he wouldn't want to be named for that. That's my first thought. Second of all, like, this is one of the great things about club cricket in the UK. There's just these guys knocking about. I remember when I was playing in the UK, actually, Mark Butcher was, like, in the competition. I played against...
Suckling.
That's right. Suckling Mushtaq. Thanks, Pez. Thanks for reminding me of my own career that I've clearly forgotten about. These guys just floating around, and like everyone else is a bit rubbish, as described in Please Keep My Name Anonymous's question. Mark Ramprakash, he typically, famously, great salad, wonderful batsman. Yes, he is completely out for the fuck out of the entire team, saying it was good exercise, which Lasith Malinga has shown to us that cricket is not that. So, I don't know, just savour the moment. These are halcyon days for your cricket career. Long will you remember this day that you played with Mark Ramprakash when he hit 55 not out, barely mishitting a single ball. So
I don't think... maybe like a number of our Australian listeners wouldn't be aware that like Mark Ramprakash is largely understood to be like the most talented batsman of his generation.
Oh, yeah.
Who wasn't able to kind of put it together at test level in a manner that matched his talent.
Mm.
Still obviously, you know, 35,659 first class runs of 53.14, but
he's like Jamie Siddons.
But he was so elegant.
I think like he was.
I remember when I was like, 13, 14, and Ramprakash was kind of in and out of the side in the 90s. And I don't know why I always wanted him to succeed, but I did. Mm. And now I look back and I realise it was because he had a sumptuous salad and just looked really, really good. He just always looked like he should be hitting lots and lots of runs at test level. And when he didn't do that, it was extremely surprising. To me.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. He was that really classic figure, like how an English batsman would look in the kind of like if it was written in fan fiction.
Yeah,
you know, by like playing to all the classic British tropes. On the flip side of this, like, and on this note, I got a text from a mate overnight who plays for a club called Nolan Dorridge in Birmingham, who like proud club. And he played a bit of grade cricket in Sydney as well, so, you know, respect.
Mm.
But he texted saying, "Mate, we're playing against a team that's undefeated this year, and we've got Ian Bell with us today." And there was a sneaky picture of him as well from the dressing room. Like, Bell wasn't aware he was having a photo taken of him, but Bell was playing in this game. And I was like, "Oh, mate, that's awesome," you know, and got a text about half an hour later saying, "Bell nicked off first ball." Like, absolute scenes from the opposition. So they're all a bit disappointed. But yeah, I guess that's the reverse of Mark Ramprakash playing. Like, oh, fuck yeah, we've got Ian Bell today. Nicks off first ball. That's cricket.
So isn't it funny that, like, in the UK, cricket just, like, it,
it's like housing this thing of like it's an enjoyable day out. Like what's Ian Bell, like why is he agreeing to play that game? Can you imagine, like, it's hard enough to get guys who are in the, you know, international setup or ever have been to like get back to like grade training, you know, to like come down, but like to spend the whole day. I remember when Mohammed Amir was done for match fixing and his captain at the time, Salman Butt, was going to jail, and Mohammed Amir got his year banned. I might have told this story before, but it was when I was in the UK and playing Surrey, and then Mohammed Amir turned up for a village side, a Saturday village side, to open the batting and bowling, and he got like 60 and took four for. And it's like he just got banned from international cricket for all cricket by the ICC for 1 year, and he's just turned out. He's like, oh, I'll still play for this village team that I don't know anyone here. Just want a game. Like, that's what that would never happen in Australia. It's just like you can enjoy it in the UK.
Well, that was the great, like, unspoken insult to grade cricket with the sandpaper ban, which is that the ban did not encompass grade cricket. So all these people who have been telling their family and friends that, like, they're a level below state, finally, you know, were exposed for playing a brand of cricket or, like, a level of cricket that
not
the ICC didn't even recognise.
Even that, like,
state.
Even that, like, snow cricket tournament that they have each year in, like, Canada or whatever, that's recognised. Well, to that end, Richard writes in for the final Ask TGC of the day. Says, gentlemen, good day to you from London. No, not Brixton, but not far off. Around this time each year, I find myself heading up to play in my ex-boss's cricket team in the Buckinghamshire hamlet of Bledlow Ridge. It's a bucolic scene. The rolling Chiltern Hills stretch out in all directions. Aging oak trees swing gently in the breeze. And crucially, a heavily subsidised club bar is on hand, selling jugs of lukewarm Foster's. Put simply, it is Britain at its very best. The match itself is a relaxed affair, 20 overs aside, a maximum of 4 overs for a bowler. Batsmen to retire at 25. A pint or two enjoyed during play, often by the umpires themselves. And a barbecue at the end of the day to raise money for the club. When either side is short of a player or two, teenage sons of fathers playing in the match often make up the numbers. In almost every respect, I think you would agree, this setting could not be further from grey cricket. But there is a problem. For although I have lived in the UK for 20 years, I grew up in Sydney. The soundtrack to every summer was cricket of every variety, a childhood steeped in intense backyard cricket games with my mates. When the first of our mates got a helmet, endless days in the nets ensured trying to knock each other's heads off. Most importantly, however, I played a handful of games in the white heat of fifth grade shires, where the abuse dished out from opposition teams and actively encouraged by our own left an indelible mark. As a rapid left armour, medium pace, and a flashing opening batsman, a 50-minute duck on one occasion, I find myself very much in and amongst it during the game. So imagine the scene when one of those teenage kids comes out to bat. Health and safety having seen to it that they now feel the need to come to the crease dressed in a level of protection not dissimilar to medieval knights of yore. They can barely walk. They're warmly clapped to the crease by our team, offered encouragement and respect for daring to take the field against men. And yet I feel no such warmth or respect towards them. Standing at the top of my mark, I see an opportunity. Ideally a cheap wicket, but I'll take a few play and misses. Most of all, though, I smell the chance to inflict pain on the young man, coupled with a long follow through to tell him, don't you fucking rub it, you little prick. I follow it up with a raising snorter of a delivery, putting him on his ass. I laugh at his predicament. Laughter, of course, being the ultimate alpha move, and a stone-faced comment of, welcome to the jungle, champ. For all those and so much more, I blame Australian cricket. It has taught me well, and this is my opportunity to repay it. What should I do? Quick cricket? Yours in sport, Rich.
I love how so many of these questions end with the, like, most non sequitur question at the end. Like, it's just a story, and then it just fits. Like, how do I add a question to this? And just as lazily, what should I do?
Yeah. Creative writing exercise. Like, these blokes just, you know, jobs working in cubicles all day. They just, this is their opportunity to just let it all out on the page. And it's beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, I mean, we're always telling people to quit cricket, and rightly so. Mm. I was thinking the other day, like, you know that movement, Hello Sunday Morning? It was like, you know, set up by some blokes who are just sick of waking up hungover on Sunday morning and missing out on life, and it's all about encouraging healthier choices and all that kind of shit.
Non-drinking.
We should obviously start a non-profit called Hello Saturday Morning for blokes who play cricket and want to quit.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Well, the
Hello
first
Saturday Morning.
And the first point of action there, though, should be that we should start a GoFundMe.
Mm-hmm. Always, whenever you've got a new idea, GoFundMe.com. Mm-hmm. crowdsource that shit.
Leave a little disclaimer down the bottom saying I may or may not use it for this purpose.
Yep, that's true. That's true.
Just, did you have anything on that question here, guys?
No. Are you sure? Quick,
there, there's a secret question that's come in.
Okay.
It's been written to me privately.
Okay.
By at Ev Cricket. Asked AGC, hi Sam, secret question about your group dynamics. It's obvious that Higos is getting massive, and it can only be one of, and it can only be one of these three things. A, Higos wants to be the alpha in TGC, and he's being massive to achieve that. B, cricket cultural critique is rig-based selection, and the way to rise to the top is by getting massive. C, it's a deeply ironic performance of masculinity in cricket to parody everything you've been talking about. Thoughts?
So many questions now, which I send in thoughts, because that's what I do. A lot of questions going on about my physique in general.
So why are you big and ripped, he goes, yep, and look at his Instagram.
Yep.
Is it because you want to be alpha of this group and you're being massive to achieve it? Is it because cricket cultural critique is rig-based selection,
yep,
and the way to rise to the top is by getting massive? Or C, is your rig and your efforts into it a deeply ironic performance, almost like method acting, if you will, about masculinity to parody everything you've been talking about?
Yep.
So are you, is your life imitating art, which is imitating life, or are you just getting ripped for alpha plays and, you know, all other benefits?
Pez, I'm glad you asked, under the guise of Ev or whatever the account was. It's a combination of all three of those things. First of all, though, I'm not massive in any way. One thing I've noticed over the last 6 months or so is that, like, when you achieve a level of, like, fitness and stuff, people just want to sledge you about it, and they also want to ask why. And I don't have the answer to those things, other than just it's something that I enjoy and it's something that I'm passionate about. I mean, that's a serious answer, but, like, yeah, it's funny. It's funny to be healthy and stuff. And, yeah, just keep those comments coming in. Thoughts?
I think what we can deduce from there is the answer is C. Thanks for the question, Ev.
Yeah.
That wasn't me, he goes. That really was.
No, I've seen that account before on the interwebs. All right, well, before we should go, we should just finally mention that, you know, tickets are available for the world tour, greatcricketer.club. You already know where we're going to be: Sydney, Melbourne, Manchester, Leeds, Birmingham, London, not necessarily in that order. Greatcricketer.club for all those tickets. You should come along because they're great nights out. We're going to announce guests in, well, we've been saying that for a while now, but we really should get to announcing the guests. They're awesome. It's going to be a fantastic night. We want to celebrate all of your cricketing experiences as well live on stage, and they're great fun, as I keep saying. So, greatcricketer.club. All right. We're going to be back on Wednesday morning, Australian time, Tuesday night, UK time, to review England-Australia. Fuck me, this World Cup is just starting to heat up.